say we will not obey. You say nous pap obéi.
Nous pap obéi.
And I know that that's something Dr. King had said, Rosa Parks had said, Malcolm X had said, and so many others have said, we will not obey legitimate rules. And then finally, I just want to say to you, if you haven't read Dr. Horn's book, I tell you, it's a mind blower. I tell you, every piece of it is just phenomenal information. And that's what we need. So thank you, Dr. Horn, for this magnificent work.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes, production intern Julianne Tweeten. And we also want to thank Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Remember to visit our website at SoTrueRadio.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki Memorial 2019 on Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. This year, the annual Hiroshima Nagasaki Memorial event is focused on the unequal impacts of nuclear weapons and will explore the disproportionate impacts that nuclear weapons have on women, children, indigenous communities, and communities of color. Again, that's Hiroshima and Nagasaki Memorial 2019, The Unequal Impacts of Nuclear Weapons, on Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kbu.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work, to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
As the person said, it is KBOO Portland. It's a little after 9 a.m., and we're going to jump right into One Land, Many Voices, after which Voices for the Animals features an interview with Thomas Chang, an activist who lays his life on the line for animal liberation. At 10:30, Film at 11 discusses one of the most anticipated films by Cinema Cognoscenti, Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And at 11, it's a radio zine. And don't forget, you can hear all these programs after they air at kboo.fm or on iTunes or Google Play. And all of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. For you to become a member, it's very easy. Start at kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. And with that, this is, as promised, One Land, Many Voices.
Hello and good morning. You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO Portland 90.7. I'm your host, Layla Kanaan, and today I'll be talking to you about mass incarceration in both the U.S. and Israel, as well as speaking to someone about the home demolitions currently happening in Palestine. Stay tuned.
You are in my speech, like the life you teach. I'll meet you by the olive tree. History, go. You and me, go. Yeah. My heartbeat, go. Palestine, Palestine, Palestine. Yeah. History, go. Uh-huh. You and me, go.
All around the world, imprisonment is used as a tool of oppression. We see it in many different countries with varying types of government. With democratic, authoritarian, socialist, or communist. But few use it as intensely as the U.S. and Israel do. They use it as a way to destabilize and ultimately ethnically cleanse Black Americans and Palestinians. Although a lot of people do know that the two are interrelated, no one really understands how deep the connection goes. But understanding the parallels between the two is the only way to fully grasp how this oppressive system works. Angela Davis, who has been a huge civil rights activist for most of her life, has also been an important advocate for the Palestinian freedom movement. She is constantly drawing parallels to the lives of Black Americans and Palestinian lives subject to Israeli law. She gives a concise explanation about the prison industrial complex and the multinational security company G4S, which has contributed immensely to the global prison industry. Here's Angela Davis.
And I would like to evoke the spirit of the South African Constitution and its opposition to racism and anti-Semitism, as well as to sexism and homophobia. This is the context within which I would like to join with you once more to intensify campaigns against another regime of apartheid and in solidarity with the struggles of the Palestinian people. As Nelson Mandela said, we know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians. Mandela's political development took place within the context of an internationalism that always urged us to make connections among freedom struggles between the Black struggle in the southern United States and the African liberation movements, for example, conducted by, of course, the ANC in South Africa, but also the MPLA in Angola, in SWAPO in Namibia, in Frelimo in Mozambique, in PAIGC in Guinea-Bissau, in Cape Verde. And those solidarities were not only among people of African descent, but with Asian and Latin American struggles as well. Ongoing solidarity with the Cuban Revolution, and of course, solidarity with the people who were struggling against US military aggression in Vietnam. And so, almost a half century later, we have inherited the legacies of those solidarities, however well or badly specific struggles may have turned out, the solidarities were what produced hope and inspiration and helped to create real conditions to move forward. So now we're confronted with the task of assisting our sisters and brothers in Palestine as they battle against Israeli apartheid. Their struggles have many similarities with those against South African apartheid, one of the most salient being the ideological condemnation of their freedom efforts under the rubric of terrorism. And I understand that evidence is being made available that indicates historical collaboration between the CIA. Well, we knew the CIA collaborated with the South African apartheid regime, but it appears that it was a CIA agent who gave South African authorities the location of Nelson Mandela's whereabouts in 1962, and that led, of course, directly to his capture and imprisonment. And it wasn't until the year 2008, that's like 5 years ago, right? That his name was taken off of the terrorist watch list when George W. Bush, maybe you remember him, when George W. Bush signed a bill that finally removed him and other members of the ANC from the list. In other words, when Mandela visited the U.S. on several occasions after his release in 1990, he was still on the terrorist list, and there had to be the requirement that he be banned from the U.S. had to be expressly waived. The point that I'm making is that for a very long time, He and his comrades shared the same status as numerous Palestinians today. And that as the U.S. explicitly collaborated with the South African apartheid government, it supported and continues to support the Israeli occupation of Palestine, currently in the form of over $8.5 million a day in military aid. The occupation would not be possible without the collaboration of the U.S. government. And that is one of the messages we need to send to Barack Obama. G4S represents the growing insistence on what is called security under the neoliberal state. And of course, Gina presented a critique of that notion of security by suggesting that feminist alternatives may be helpful as we attempt to reconceptualize what security should mean. The ideologies of security represented by G4S bolster not only the privatization of security, but the privatization of imprisonment, the privatization of warfare, as well as the privatization of health care and the privatization of education. G4S is responsible for the repressive treatment of political prisoners inside Israel and through the organization Ademir, which is directed by Sahar Francis, who's absolutely amazing. And some of you may have had the opportunity to hear her, but she travels all over the country and she provides us with information. She and her organization, Ademir, provide us with information about what is happening both inside the prisons and outside. We've learned about the terrifying universe of torture and imprisonment that is faced by so many Palestinians, but we've also learned about their spirit of resistance. We've learned about their hunger strikes and other forms of resistance that continue to take place behind the walls.
So, I'm going to try to paint a picture for you of how intense Israeli imprisonment of Palestinians really is. Since 1967, almost 1 million Palestinians have been imprisoned. This means that every single person in the occupied West Bank knows someone who has been imprisoned. My cousin, who's only 23, has been imprisoned twice already. The first time he was 16 and was unable to finish high school because of it, and then the second time when he was 19. While he was in prison, my family had a difficult time obtaining a permit to go see him because the prison he was located in was in Israel. But Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank don't hold the correct ID cards that give them travel access to Israel. So for the first few months of his imprisonment, his parents and siblings were unable to see him. This story is common, though. Many Palestinian men will be detained 2 to 3 times in their life, which, of course, has impacts on the function and productivity of society. Children then grow up fearing inevitable arrest, and there are many children that don't have the privilege of having an imprisonment-free childhood. Israel arrests hundreds of Palestinian children each year. Many are forcibly removed from their homes in the middle of the night, they're violently interrogated without a lawyer, and are coerced into signing confessions written in Hebrew, which many can't understand. Human Rights Watch has said that, quote, Palestinian children are treated in ways that would terrify and traumatize an adult. Screams, threats, and beatings are no way for the police to treat a child or to get accurate information from them, unquote. In 2016, Israel passed a law that would allow Israeli authorities to imprison minors as young as 12 years old. And in 2018, there were 271 Palestinian children detained by Israel, and so far in 2019, 207 Palestinian children have been detained. And it's only July. Another arrest tactic used by Israelis is a procedure called administrative detention, which essentially allows Israelis to arrest Palestinians without charge or trial. The detention orders are issued for periods of up to 6 months and can be extended indefinitely. Israel has used the administrative detention tactic upwards of 50,000 times on Palestinians. So, how does all of this relate to the U.S.? Well, the U.S. has been a major market for Israeli technologies of surveillance and control that have been frequently tested on imprisoned Palestinians and civilians living in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. But not only are weapons and technologies tested on Palestinians, Israel also trains American police officers in how to properly treat and arrest detainees. Since 9/11, pro-Israel lobbying groups have created an industry of taking police chiefs from major U.S. cities to Israel so they can learn, quote, from the best, unquote. The brutality exhibited by Israeli soldiers is taught to U.S. policemen, which we have seen over and over during protests when they use tear gas, which was most likely tested on Palestinians, and with unarmed civilians being shot and killed by police. Palestinians, all of whom are under the control of Israel, and people of color in the U.S. find themselves facing pretty similar discriminatory ideologies and policies, as well as systems of control that are interconnected. Despite the countless human rights violations Israel has perpetrated, the U.S. continues to portray Israel as a glimmering light of hope in an otherwise dark and oppressive region of the world. Obama himself has said, quote, the establishment of Israel was just and necessary, and that the bond between Israel and the U.S. is rooted in more than our shared national interests. It's rooted in the shared values and shared stories of our people. And as president, I will work with you to ensure that it is a bond that is strengthened, unquote. The shared values Obama is talking about is, quote, a commitment to human dignity, a belief that freedom is a right that is given to all of God's children, an experience that shows us that democracy is the one and only form of government that can truly respond to the aspirations of citizens, unquote. And by shared stories? Maybe he's talking about how both Israel and the U.S. were established by European settler colonialists who violently took land inhabited by indigenous people. Understanding the present-day experience of Black Americans and other people of color in the U.S. offers critically important lessons to Palestinians and highlights that the struggle for Palestinian human rights must be closely linked to the struggle for human rights in the U.S. and around the world. Anyway, what often overshadows the treatment of Black Americans in the U.S. is the steps the U.S. has taken to create a more equal society, like the abolition of slavery, the civil rights movement and the end of segregation, comprehensive civil rights legislation ending discrimination in education, housing and employment, and writing votes. These milestones are easy to acknowledge and accept and are celebrated as milestones towards the realization that all people are created equal. It's also easy to acknowledge that racial gaps in health, wealth, and education exist in Black communities. But these disparities are talked about in terms of legacies from slavery and Jim Crow, and not about the current system that is perpetrating these very real and very harmful systems of control. The U.S. is often portrayed as having made progress in economic equality, but incarcerated Black men have been excluded from national statistics on voting, wages, employment, and education. In fact, life for Black Americans has deteriorated since their victories during the civil rights era. In the book The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, the author Michelle Alexander explains, quote, that the optimistic liberal narrative that emphasizes the death of slavery and Jim Crow and celebrates the nation's triumph over race with the election of Barack Obama is dangerously misguided. Mass incarceration has emerged as a stunningly comprehensive and well-designed system of racialized social control that functions in a manner strikingly similar to Jim Crow, unquote. Within 30 years, the prison population went from 300,000 people to 2 million. More Black adults are in prison or under correctional supervision than were enslaved in 1850 in the U.S. In 2004, more African American men were denied the right to vote due to felon disenfranchisement laws than in 1870. Black men are admitted to prison on drug charges at a rate ranging from 20 to 57 times greater than a white man, even though people of all races use and sell drugs at roughly the same rate. I'll just let that sink in. U.S. incarceration rates far surpass Russia, China, and Iran, all of which the West claims to be significantly repressive. In some urban communities, 3 of every 4 black men can expect to serve time in prison. Now, like I said before, the act of imprisonment isn't isolated to just being in prison, and this is especially significant in the U.S. Those who are either in prison, on probation, or on parole are barred from voting, working, participating in jury duty, finding housing, and other really important but basic social activities. Mass incarceration essentially started with the war on drugs. Politicians preyed on people's fears of social disorder and linking crime to the kind of social disobedience used during the struggle to end Jim Crow. Nixon explained to his advisor that, quote, "You have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this without appearing to," unquote. The war on drugs was used essentially as a vehicle to push racialized rhetoric on crime without using language that's explicitly racist or discriminatory. In 1985, when the crack cocaine epidemic took off, Reagan successfully used propaganda to associate drugs and crime with people of color. Stereotypes of crack whores, crack babies, and young black men as predators became common. Hillary Clinton is seen on C-SPAN in 1996 explaining the fear of super predators. Take a listen.
"The fourth challenge is to take back our streets from crime, gangs, and drugs. And we have actually been making progress on this count as a nation because of what local law enforcement officials are doing, because of what citizens and neighborhood patrols are doing. We're making some progress. Much of it is related to the initiative called community policing, because we have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994. He promised 100,000 police. We're moving in that direction, but we can see it already makes a difference, because if we have more police interacting with people, having them on the streets, we can prevent crimes. We can prevent petty crimes from turning into something worse. But we also have to have an organized effort against gangs, just as in a previous generation we had an organized effort against the mob. We need to take these people on. They are often connected to big drug cartels. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel. And the president has asked the FBI to launch a very concerted effort against gangs everywhere. In addition to that, he has appointed a new drug czar. You probably saw him Tuesday night. He's one of the most distinguished active military generals that we have in our country. He's already proven that he knows how to interdict drugs because of his command of the South American activity on behalf of the United States. But General McCaffrey will make a big difference, and I believe it is now time for all of us to know what we can do individually to be part of this anti-crime, anti-gangs, anti-drug effort. The fifth challenge is to protect the environment.
This exact type of discourse is also used by Israeli politicians when portraying black African migrants and asylum seekers. They're painted as criminals, even though their crime rate is lower than that of the Israeli population. Another tactic used by American policemen on people of color is the Stop and Frisk program. In 2011, 658,724 people were stopped by the NYPD under this program, and 80% of them were African American or Latino males. It's uncalled for, it's harassment, and it's racist. Here's a clip from the Reuters news agency investigating the experience of residents living in Brownsville, a neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, that has the highest rate of stop and frisks. There is, of course, still the legacy of slavery within American society that hasn't been addressed, but that isn't the only contributor to the significant institutional racism that we see. Imprisonment is used as a form of control over oppressed populations, whether it's Palestinians or Black Americans. We cannot allow racist rhetoric to inaccurately shape our view of people of color in America, in the Middle East, and all over the world. I'm now going to play a clip from a video of a group of activists, artists, musicians, and journalists from the U.S. who traveled to Palestine in 2015 to build on the growing bonds of solidarity between the Black American and Palestinian liberation struggles.
We came here to Palestine to stand in love and revolutionary struggle with our brothers and sisters.
Black Lives Matter, Black Youth Project 100.
We come to a land that has been stolen by greed and destroyed.
Spent 10 days connecting with Palestinian activists.
We come here and we learn
the group witnessed firsthand what it means to live under Israeli occupation and apartheid. But written in the blood of the innocent. Here's a clip.
And we stand next to people who continue to courageously struggle and resist the occupation. People continue to dream and fight for freedom. From Ferguson to Palestine, the struggle for freedom continues.
Of settlements, while the sound of suffering sails lost in the listening as the voices of heartache hail. The power of presence, people as portals, passports to heaven. Here is a protest in the form of a prayer. God is in the holy water lining the lower lids of Ali's eyes, a tear, a river against a cheek, waiting in old Jerusalem, sitting on a leaning chair in the market, the lonely storyteller God. God is a woman holding a crying baby in her arms at a checkpoint in Ramallah, waiting at the gates like cattle. God, God is in the rubble, gnarled hands rinsing in an open fire, a journey of dreamers singing through empty streets in Bethlehem. We survive in the telling, unafraid, we survive in the telling, we survive. Watan badun shab wa shab badun watan. We survive.
What if occupation's a dream the Palestinians had? Grills underneath their teeth and they suddenly relapse. Saw the ships at the bay or the West Bank shore. Woke up and the occupation existed no more. What if Zionism is the second coming of Christ? Destruction is the matrimony in sight, because if we are the Messiah, then God is not white. What if life is the afterlife and we already dead? The footage of the moment replayed in your head, looping over until you die for the second time. What if power influence your intelligence and mind? And those with the lesser are really the oppressors. Would you still steal this land under that pressure? Free Palestine.
Palestine to Ferguson in the occupation. Ferguson to Palestine, we fight to free our nations. Palestine to Ferguson
in the occupation.
Ferguson to Palestine, we fight to save our nation.
Hold up.
We did it.
Oh man, I got to.
It's a group hug. Group hug. Come on.
We
more
in
love.
Here.
More love.
Yellow.
Yes, you are. I'm a Palestinian girl.
Black Lives Matter! Oh, if you have the chance to watch that clip in full, you definitely should. It's called Ferguson Activists Bring Message of Love and Struggle to Palestine. It's an extremely inspiring video, and I get chills every time I watch it. In the second half of my show, I will be interviewing Beth, one of the four International Solidarity Movement activists protesting the home demolitions in the West Bank and Jerusalem. Stay tuned.
Search for tranquility.
So I'll just start by giving you a little bit of background on the home demolitions happening in Palestine and East Jerusalem. We talked about mass incarceration of Palestinians already, but of course there are other tactics Israelis use to ethnically cleanse Palestinians, and one of them is home demolitions, which we are seeing happen right now in East Jerusalem in the neighborhood Wadi al-Hummus. Even when Palestinians and human rights activists try to resist the demolitions, they are met with tear gas and severe beatings from the Israeli occupation forces. Videos have come out of Israeli soldiers laughing, clapping, and cheering as Palestinian apartment buildings are being blown up in the background. The deputy director of Amnesty International said that these demolitions are blank, flagrant violations of international law and part of a systematic pattern, unquote. The European Union said that it, quote, expects the Israeli authorities to immediately halt the ongoing demolitions, unquote. But all we continue to see is more support for these demolitions. Israel plans to demolish 13 apartment buildings, which would displace thousands of Palestinian residents. What makes these demolitions even more difficult is that the residents losing their homes are refugees facing displacement two or three times over. And the reason for the demolitions? Apparently, the buildings present a security risk to Israel's so-called security barrier, 85% of which runs through occupied Palestinian territory. And the worst part? The Israeli authorities will be billing the residents for the demolition costs. So not only are they destroying homes, but they're profiting from it too. What we see here is that the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians is not only a state policy, but it's celebrated by the Israelis. What needs to happen now is not a deal of the century from Jared Kushner, no more peace talks. That does nothing for Palestinian freedom, but for people to talk about it, to push back, to support BDS, recognize the parallels between Israeli treatment of Palestinians and Black and Indigenous maltreatment in America, and realize without justice here or there, there will not be justice anywhere. And now I'll be speaking to Beth about her on-the-ground experience with the Israelis that are demolishing Palestinian homes. Hey, Beth, welcome. I'm so glad that we could talk.
No problem.
So I guess let's start with a little introduction about yourself. What are you doing in Palestine?
Yeah, so I came to Palestine in early June to volunteer with an organization that does humanitarian observation and activism. So what we do is we go to different things such as protests, house demolitions. We stay in the South Hebron Hills and kind of watch over shepherds, just any kind of situations where soldiers or settlers will harass Palestinians and abuse their rights. We're there to kind of observe, document, share, and in some cases prevent some things happening.
How many people are you with? How many people do you do this with?
It varied over the whole time I've been here, but at the moment there's 13 of us.
Oh, wow. There's a lot. Are they from all over the world?
Yeah, from the U.S., China, France, mainly from Britain, Catalonia.
And what are you all doing in Palestine now?
Kind of our daily life changes because we're kind of on call, so we have contacts within the Palestinian community who ask us to come to things. At the moment, like, I've just come back from Wadi El Hummus, where on Monday there was a mass demolition. The community wanted to give us dinner to thank us for our presence there and our support. Yeah, so, and then tomorrow, Fridays are a big day in Palestine because there are many protests, so we'll all be going off to different places to document likely disproportionate violence against Palestinians, like throwing tons of tear gas, rubber bullets, yeah, and things like this.
And what was your experience in Wadi El Hummus with the demolitions?
Horrific. We were staying in a man called Ishmael's house, which he lives in with his six children and his wife. And he'd spent years building this house, like everything with his own hands. It was one of the houses up for demolition that day. One big unfinished block where I think about 350 people were going to live. Another house down the road and some other houses. The Israeli soldiers, they came at around three in the morning. So we were woken up by really loud sounds of the gate being blowtorched open, the separation wall, and so many soldiers coming through, like busload after busload. At 5 a.m. we then saw loads running next to the house, and we knew they were going to come in.
And you were staying in this house?
Yeah, we were staying in Ishmael's house. We'd been there the night before, and thinking a demolition might happen in the morning, and it didn't.
And do they get some type of notice that says that the Israelis will demolish their house in a certain period of time, or is it all surprise?
So they wanted to demolish these houses for many years because they want this land. They want land in East Jerusalem. So there was years of court cases over this. And eventually it went to the Supreme Court, and the final kind of ticket they used was these houses pose a security threat because they're too close to the separation wall. So the Supreme Court said, okay, well, military knows best, so we're just going to let you demolish the house. And they had until the 18th of July to self-demolish their homes. Otherwise, the bulldozers were going to come in. And they came in on the 22nd, so 4 days later.
Oh, my gosh. So, sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about how the Israelis were surrounding the house?
Yeah, so they then stormed the house. Four of us, we went to the bathroom, and we had these chains that we chained ourselves together. They had little clips so we could take them off, so they kind of looked more secure than they were. And we were trying to delay the demolition because in the past, activists have delayed a demolition long enough that the court then found, like, lawyers found other ways to prevent the demolition from happening, which is what happened last year with a Bedouin village. But this time we were in the bathroom and we were just sitting there holding each other, and all we could hear was just shouting and banging. And eventually, maybe 1 minute later, after just hearing so much shouting and screaming, a soldier was at the door and he shouted at us in Hebrew, and we don't speak Hebrew, so we didn't know what he said. He threw in a tear gas canister and then closed the door on us.
Oh my God.
So we were all sitting there and choking and suffocating. And then the next thing, the soldiers came in and dragged us all out. I was dragged out. I was wearing a keffiyeh, which is like a scarf around my neck. and they dragged me by my keffiyeh and out the bathroom, and it was like I was then being like suffocating from not only the gas but from being strangled. Mm. I was closing my eyes this whole time. I can't really explain to you why. In that moment, I just didn't really register the fact I could open my eyes. And then I started screaming out of anger, and because I just couldn't believe what was happening. And at this point, the soldier was like, he got really angry, like more angry. He then got on top of me and he like crushed his knee into my neck. Then I felt another soldier grab my hair and pull me out by my hair. And I was hearing my friends screaming as well, and as I had my eyes closed, I just didn't know what was happening to them. When I eventually opened my eyes, the floor was covered in blood, and I thought, like, they've probably killed one of the guys, one of Ishmael's family, because I just had no idea what was going on, and I'd never experienced that kind of brutality in my life. I kind of opened my eyes as I was sitting on the bottom of the stairs, and Chris, he tapped me on the shoulder and was like, Beth, we need to leave. So that's when I knew the action was over, and we'd failed to delay the demolition by even 10 minutes. It was really quick.
It was very fast.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, that was the experience inside the house.
Were you then taken to a hospital to get checked?
So once we'd all been kicked out of the house, we were then, yeah, the border police, who were like soldiers, they pushed us and made us walk for a long time away from the house while they kind of laughed and stepped on our feet. Mm. And my friend, she was really badly pepper sprayed in the eyes and the hands, and she was screaming. So some of the Palestinians, even though they had been really badly pepper sprayed and beaten and kicked down the stairs when they had said they were going to stop resisting, they were outside with her, and they drove her really fast to a hospital. Maybe half an hour later, we were taken. My friend Chris in the house, he was stamped on in the neck and the chest. So he was in a really bad way. He was in the worst way. We went to a hospital in East Jerusalem. He ended up having a fractured rib. I have these really awful, like, red abrasion marks across my neck, but I had an ultrasound. Unfortunately, I don't have any internal damage. Mm-hmm. Another friend in the room with me in the bathroom, she has a fractured knuckle and severe tissue damage to her other hand. So she's going to need to have like plastic surgery if it's going to look normal again. The girl who was pepper sprayed, she was okay, but she was in pain all day from the pepper spray. But I think in the end we were lucky, because we were in that room and no one was filming, and they were just doing what they wanted, and I think it could have been a lot worse. This same unit, they call it Yassam, and they're notorious in Jerusalem. And I heard later that they use these, they are trained with these tactics to like break people's fingers, throw tear gas inside, stamp on people's necks. They're trained to do this in terms of like prison riots. They use these tactics when there's a riot in a prison. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of things that we were facing, this family was facing. And they were using this to destroy people's homes. It's just insane when you think about it.
It's just, I mean, I read an article that said that Israelis are billing the families of the demolished homes for the demolition. And I understand that all of this is just an absolutely absurd situation, but the fact that they can, on top of it, profit from these demolitions, I shake with anger thinking about it.
They have to pay for the own demolition of the demolition of their own houses.
Their own houses. It's just, it's cruel. So how, what are Ishmael and his family doing now?
So now they're living with his father, and I believe his father only has one spare room, so it's him and his wife and his six kids in a very small space. I think the PA are going to compensate the family. I hope they do. So, yeah, I'm hoping they're not going to be as in debt as they would be, but yeah, I don't know. That he says he'll live in a tent on top of the rubble of his home. He's still defiant, which is amazing to see, because I don't think I would be the same.
I mean, it's just like time and again I see Palestinians show this immense amount of resistance and resilience, and it amazes me every time. I can't wrap my head around it. They go through so much hurt and pain and destruction, but they still somehow end up on top.
Yeah, remarkable.
Yeah, remarkable people.
Yeah.
So what is next? What is happening next with you and your group?
Next, there's more houses in the area that have demolition orders. So the demolitions there are not over by any means. And the scary thing is that these houses were demolished in Area A,
mm-hmm.
Palestinian Authority control. So it sets a really dangerous precedent that many other communities, Palestinian communities that live within 150 to 300 meters of the wall, are also at risk of demolition.
Well, and it's also saying that Oslo Accords are over, because if Israel can just completely disregard areas A, B, and C,
mm-hmm.
which they already have most of the control over Palestine, so I just don't understand what else they need. But now apparently they have control over areas A and B, which I was under the impression that the Palestinian Authority controlled, but I guess that is obsolete at this point.
Yeah, definitely. There's no kind of kidding anymore that they're following the agreement, because they're just not. I think it's quite a depressing time, but also it's the people are still really still like are ready to fight the occupation. And we were just with Ishmael, and he was getting like higher and higher spirits as the night was going on, just seeing how many people were there to support him. And he was just saying like, I'm not going to give up, and I'm still going to rebuild my home, and we're still going to build. So it hasn't crushed the community as much as Israel wants, which was amazing to see.
Of course. And like, Palestinians have been through it all. I was talking to my dad. My dad's Palestinian, and I was just saying, how much more can Palestinians take? Because it just feels that they get hit over and over and over, whether it's a war or home demolition or checkpoints or imprisonment. And he just said that it's in Palestinian blood to just keep going. They'll just keep pushing, and they have no other choice but to keep going. And eventually one of them is going to fall, and it's not going to be Palestine or Palestinians.
Inshallah.
Inshallah, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Beth. We've run out of time, but I really, really appreciate hearing what you have to say and what you went through. And it gives me hope knowing that there are people from all around the world that are speaking out for Palestinians.
Well, thank you for listening and spreading, because that's so important.
We need to hear your stories for sure. Thank you again, Beth.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Have a nice night.
You too.
History, go, you and me, go, my heartbeat, go, Philistine, Philistine, Philistine.
Again, that was Beth, volunteering with the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine, protesting the home demolitions of Palestinians. You heard the song Palestine by Isha Fukushima, and clips including Angela Davis and From Ferguson to Palestine, The Struggle Continues. I hope you enjoyed listening to my show. If you missed any part of the show, you can go to kboo.fm/onelandmanyvoices. See you next time.
No limits to the love we speak. Old city.
go. Palestine, Palestine, Palestine. Yeah. History go. You and me go. Okay. My heartbeat go. Palestine, Palestine, Palestine. I pray the world will find its sanity. For the whole of humanity.
Thank you.
نار روزانك واللي هوا فيها وش عملت الروزانة الله يجازيها
عالروزانة عالروزانة كل ليل الهوى فيها وش عملت الروزانة الله يجازيها
يا رايح حين حالة حبي معكم راح يا محملين العنب فوقي عنب
كيبو at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil on Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, Cuba's oil supply was cut by more than half. This film tells of the hardships and struggles, as well as the community and creativity of the Cuban people during this transition away from a highly mechanized agricultural system to one using organic methods of farming and local urban gardens. Again, that's How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that, too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm.